Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking with Martin Shaw. Shaw is the author of the thought-provoking new book, Genocide in International Relations, published by Cambridge University Press. In the book, Shaw subjects the modern thinking about genocide, both scholarly and activist, to a piercing examination, and finds it wanting in some ways. He then sketches out an alternative framework for thinking about genocide and tests its validity by examining the history of genocide in the past 150 years. It's an excellent book, one that will challenge many to rethink their ideas about the field. I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk to Martin with it today. And with that, Martin, welcome, and thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thank you, Kelly. It's nice to have this opportunity to talk about my work.
Well, why don't we start out by going before your work and asking you to talk a little bit about who you are and how you became a sociologist.
Well, I became a sociologist a long time ago. I was always interested in politics, actually, and through politics I became interested in society. This was the 1960s when sociology was very fashionable as the discipline which would help us to understand what was going on in the world, and so that's why I went into sociology, I suppose. And I was very much involved with the issues of that period as a activist as well as a somebody who thought about these things and studied them.
See, you talk about yourself as a historical sociologist. For those non-sociologists in the audience, can you say something about what the subfield is about and why you find it so valuable?
Well, as a historical sociologist, I'm interested in what C. Wright Mills called middle range theory. I'm interested in theory which isn't either very, very grand, very, very abstracted, or very detailed empirical, close empirical study, but in the sort of generalizations we can make about trends over broad historical periods and in particular epochs. And I find that the most satisfying sort of sociology, neither so general and abstract as to be difficult to connect to an understanding of what's going on in the world, nor so tightly focused or narrowly focused that we miss the big picture. So it's a big picture sort of sociology that is concerned very much with change, with continuity and change. Obviously, continuity is an important part of everything, but with how things change over time and how different historical periods pose different sorts of problems of analysis as well as problems for people who live in.
You mentioned that you were an activist. How did you get interested in the mass violence as a subject of research?
I suppose I got interested in it because from quite an early age. I mean, I grew up in the aftermath. Well, I was born in the aftermath of the Second World War. I grew up in the period of the Cold War. When I was a young adult, there was the Vietnam War. All these realities focused me very much on the problem of war. And when I became an academic, although I was interested in some other subjects, first of all, I quickly moved in by the beginning of the 1980s. I was working mainly on issues to do with war and conflict. And I wrote quite a few studies of this kind. But I got involved with issues of genocide because I realized all along in when I was writing about war that really genocide was tied up with war, and it was very difficult to write properly about war without writing also about genocide. And I was asked to write a textbook on war, and this was in the late 90s, and I eventually produced the book, which is called War and Genocide, which was actually an attempt to look at war, but in bringing in genocide and showing how the two are related. And that was my first entry into the genocide field. I mean, I suppose, you know, I was becoming more aware of the history and the, for example, when I was growing up, and everybody, the Second World War was so much part of the background, that the Holocaust and other genocides of that period were not really so much a part of the story about the war as they are now. And so, you know, it took a time to actually hone in on this particular problem.
So what brings you to write this book?
Well, this book is really it's the third book I've written, which is concerned mm-hmm. with genocide. And the first one, as I just mentioned, was War and Genocide. The second was called What is Genocide? And was a book about the concept and the ideas. It was very much, work trying to look at the very contested nature of the genocide concept and the debates around it from the point of view of social theory, and to bring what I hope was a rigorous sociological approach to bear on the concept of genocide. But having written that, I felt very dissatisfied that I'd only dealt with things at the conceptual level. Mm. And although the book contains quite a lot of illustrations and it's certainly not disconnected from the debates about the historical problems. It doesn't present a historical framework, although it argues for one. And so really, I felt I wanted to write something which would look at the changing patterns of genocide, would look at the problem of genocide from the historical sociological point of view that I was trying to explain before. And this is really what this book is trying to do in the first place. Secondly, I wanted to look at the patterns of genocide from a perspective which takes into account the many cases of genocide which are not on a very large scale, which are not what Mark Levine calls the mega genocides, mm-hmm. but are much more smaller scale, often localized, but nevertheless much more common than the very large scale genocides. And I wanted to look at the pattern of genocide in a very broad way, which included these smaller as well as the larger scale episodes, and to look at this across different historical periods of the recent past. Well, there wasn't a third reason, but I forgot the third reason was. So come back.
Well, you start...
Oh, the third reason, The third reason, of course, was to connect the study of these patterns of genocide to a theoretical approach deriving from international relations, and to look at the ways in which the changing patterns of genocide were related to mm-hmm. the changing forms of the international system, the development of the international system, and particularly to look at the way we have very different patterns of genocide. For example, in the late 19th century, we talk about genocide, we're still very much talking, I think, about colonial genocide, which has been the main area of genocide in the previous 100 or 200 years. Then in the first part of the 20th century, genocide becomes a really big problem in Europe, and genocide is much more state-centered than it was before. Many more radical party states are coming to the fore and are the agents of a new, generally much larger scale type of genocide. We think of the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and then. But what was interesting for me was to look at what comes after that during the Cold War and the post-Cold War era, and the ways in which the patterns of genocide have changed again from those of the period leading up to and during the Second World War, and to look at how those patterns are related to the changes in the international system, the big changes which took place after the Second World War and after the end of the Cold War.
The nature of research about genocide is a key element of this book. So I'd like to ask you to say something about the emergence of the field of genocide studies and the consequences of the way that field emerged, for how genocide gets studied now.
Yeah, so this is a big preoccupation, if you like, a background preoccupation of mm-hmm. this book. It's something I already touched on in the previous book. My take on the way in which genocide studies has developed is that it has been very much influenced by the ways in which very few particular genocides that have been understood in society, and the ways in which certain groups of scholars have often, for cultural and personal as well as intellectual reasons, come to look at particular cases, and that the paradigm of genocide studies has developed particularly from the case of the Holocaust, which of course was in the broader framework of the Nazi genocide, was what Raphael Lemkin started out with when he invented the concept of genocide. And I think that the field has been skewed in a sense by its starting point. The starting point is too dominant, that the other cases are understood in terms of their relationship to the Holocaust, in terms of what Jeffrey Alexander calls a bridging from the Holocaust. So, for example, the Armenian genocide became recognized, very widely recognized, at least by scholars, if not by the Turkish government, because of the campaigning and the writing of scholars who linked the Armenian genocide very consciously to the Holocaust and emphasized the similarities between the two cases. And I think that was in many ways a necessary and an avoidable starting point, but I think it's a very limited starting point. If we're constantly comparing, establishing genocides, if we're constantly in our academic study driven by trying to gain recognition for particular genocides by comparing them to other genocides, then I think that is not really a normal social scientific or historical procedure, and it's not really even a normal comparative study. A comparative study would be a more developed comparative study would not just compare one case to another, but would have an overall framework, a general concept, a framework of classification of the whole universe of cases, not just of 1, 2, 3 particular cases. And I think the way in which the field has been developed has been skewed by its over-reliance on a few cases. And also, I think it's been skewed by the fact that it's so closely linked, the field has been so closely linked to arguments about establishing recognition of genocides by the sort of cultural, political, and the moral agendas, often very understandable agendas, ones with which I might sympathize, but nevertheless agendas which are not really academic agendas.
You point out, and I forget, I'm sorry, I don't remember if this is your phrase, I think you're quoting somebody, that the idea that genocide has become a sacred evil. Mm. What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, the phrase is Jeffrey Alexander's, I just mentioned.
Yes.
He actually says that the Holocaust has become a sacred evil. Mm-hmm. The Holocaust has become an event which is so evil that we can't study it in normal historical or academic terms, that we have to treat it as something with almost a sort of religious awe, as the opposite of good or of the valuable. This is the paradigm of evil in our times, and therefore we can't treat it in any way normally. And he makes the case that this actually makes it very difficult to understand the Holocaust properly, because it was an event that took place in history. It, it was something which was the product of quite normal, historical the process of modernity, bureaucracy, racism, all the other sorts of normal social factors that would go into other terrible events were present in the Holocaust, and we need to be able to understand it in the same framework which we understand other things. So he poses this concept of sacred evil. What I add, I think, is to say that I think that the genocide in general has come to be seen as a sort of sacred evil. That we that as soon as we say something is a genocide, then it is treated completely differently in the minds of many people from something which we don't call a genocide. And so actually then you have this sort of a very invidious dividing line between those episodes which can be called genocides and those which can't, which are, for example, only or merely ethnic cleansing. And I think that's a very, very dangerous road to go down.
So you started this discussion a little bit. Can I ask you to kind of go further with this idea of the paradigm of comparative genocide, which is what you suggest most of genocide studies is right now? What, aside from this idea of looking one-to-one from the Holocaust to something else, what are these basic assumptions that shape this way of studying the field?
Well, there are quite a lot of assumptions, but I suppose the key assumptions are that what the field should be concerned with are genocides, which are by definition large scale discrete episodes of violence, which can be treated ahistorically and compared to each other across time. So one of the examples that I talk about quite a bit is the way in which comparative genocide studies includes quite a lot of discussion of, you know, how the Armenian genocide is similar to the Holocaust, or how the Rwandan genocide is similar to the Holocaust. And the Rwandan genocide in particular, I mean, obviously clearly there are some similarities with the Holocaust, and it may be illuminating to discuss them, but these two genocides took place in very different historical periods. They were the products of different sorts of domestic and international political factors. They were mobilized in significantly different ways, and they need to be seen, I think, in different sorts of contexts. So I think it's much more illuminating to look at the Holocaust in the context of the period of the Second World War, and more generally the period of conflicts between major world empires, and the ways in which the Holocaust is linked to other genocide in the same period. So, for example, we might consider the linkages between the Holocaust and the genocide that was committed by the Stalinist regime in the Soviet Union, which occurred in the same period, often in more or less the same regions, and often conditioned by the international conflict between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, which was part of the larger conflict of the Second World War. So I think it's actually much more constructive to look at the Holocaust in that context of the larger problem of violence, of genocidal violence in the Second World War period and in the larger historical period of which it was a culmination. And then turning to the Rwandan genocide, to look at the Rwandan genocide in the context of the more complex and longer term pattern of violence in the Great Lakes region of Africa, which included the not only the previous episodes of violence in Rwanda itself, the genocidal massacres of the early 1960s, which very much set the tone for what happened in the 90s, but also the genocide in Burundi in 1972, the genocidal episodes in Uganda, where, of course, the Tutsi refugees from Rwanda went. And to look at the Rwanda genocide in the sense of the culmination of a set of transnational border, cross-border, international and transnational processes, a lot to do with refugee flows, which were crucial, as René Lamarchand has argued, in forming the context of the genocide. And then to look at the Rwanda genocide not as a culmination in the way which you might say the Holocaust was a culmination of its period, but the Rwanda genocide in a sense was not only a culmination of what had gone before, but a starting point for new genocidal violence particularly in what became the Democratic Republic of Congo in the late 90s and early 2000s. So to look at this whole regional context in an international, transnational way seems to me to be much more illuminating than to compare the Holocaust in Rwanda, which is what so many people have done and what so many students are asked to do in their essays.
I will neither confirm nor deny that I've asked them to do that in my class. However, I may not anymore. And that is, in some sense, your basic claim in the book, right? That the nature and characteristics of genocide change over time.
Yes.
And that these changes are related to changes in the international system.
Yes.
That rests on a certain kind of definition of genocide, or perhaps to use your phrase, genocidal violence, which differs from other understandings of genocide. So how do you understand what genocide is, and how you're going to use that category in your research?
Well, this is obviously a very important question, and I suppose I do have the benefit of having written the book about it beforehand, so I didn't go into this making it up as I go along. But I understand it. I think I understand it. I mean, not entirely differently from how other people understand it. I see myself as following broadly in the footsteps of Raphael Lemkin's original definition of genocide, mm-hmm. which was a broad definition in the sense that he understood genocide as the destructive violence against a particular group or groups of people. Defined in his case, particularly emphasized nationality or ethnicity, but the definition is capable of being extended to include other types of group. And he emphasized. You can go see this in his original 1944 book, Axis Rule and mm-hmm. Occupied Europe, where he talks about the Nazi genocide as something which involved 8 different methods of destruction. So killing and direct physical violence were only one out of the 8 methods of genocide which Lemkin identified in the Nazi case. Genocide is really the targeted destruction of a social collectivity or a group in the general terminology which people use. And this takes place through many different means. So I would emphasize not only killing and physical violence directed towards people indiscriminately, irrespective of sex and gender. I would emphasize the role of sexual violence, which has been very important in all genocides, but only really recognized in the last 20 years, as we've looked at cases like Yugoslavia and Rwanda. I would emphasize the role of the forced removal of populations, with the uprooting of populations. These are all methods of genocide, all methods through which social collectivities are destroyed. And the question of the level of killing, which many other people make crucial there, because there are many people who define genocide simply as mm-hmm. mass killing. This was always regarded by Lemkin as one element of genocide, and I think that's correct. And I think the level of mass killing is an empirical question rather than something which defines genocide and delimits genocide from other phenomena.
So let me ask, from the perspective of somebody who's not an expert, doesn't do research, seems to me the logical follow-up question then would be, and I recognize this goes directly against what you just said, but is there some kind of lower boundary in terms of numbers? Can you reasonably talk about 100 deaths being genocide if, for instance, the group of people or not even deaths, of course, but deportations or whatever way that this group is being destroyed. Yeah. If the group is small enough, does that reasonably count as genocide?
Well, I don't think there is a numerical threshold for either deaths or expulsions or rapes or any other sort of violence or coercion which is involved in genocide. Genocide is in my definition, genocide is first of all a type of action. It's targeted action aimed at the destruction of a group. Secondly, it's a form of conflict, because as soon as one organized actor tries to destroy a social collectivity, then there's going to be resistance from that collectivity and usually from other actors as well. And thirdly, genocide, of course, is an outcome. Genocide is, you know, we can measure the number of deaths and other forms of victimization. A form of action can be characterized as genocide even if it's not successful. So we can talk mm-hmm. about genocide. I mean, for example, the expulsion of the Kosovo Albanians in 1999 by the Milosevic regime, which involved about 10,000 people being killed, but 1.5 million being expelled from their homes. In the end, we would say that was an unsuccessful genocide because most of the people who were expelled were able to return because NATO mm-hmm. intervened and defeated Serbia. And so we would say that the genocidal element of Milosevic's attempt to uproot the Kosovo Albanian society was in the end very limited in its outcome. But nevertheless, it seems to me an attempt to destroy Kosovo Albanian society, which we should see as a genocide, and which I would define as a genocide, even if only 100 people have been killed rather than 10,000. Clearly, there are many cases, if we think about colonial genocides, there are many cases where the peoples who were being destroyed by the colonists were, you know, relatively small indigenous peoples, maybe numbering a few thousand or a few hundred. You know, 100 deaths in those cases, it would be a very significant number of deaths, which would say that something very, very serious was happening to that society. So I think we can't set a sort of numerical threshold. It doesn't help us in trying to understand what's going on to do that.
So with that as the background, because that's going to shape the kind of case studies you choose and the discussion, historical discussion you engage in, you talk about three different periods in the international system. And I'd like to go through each quickly and give you a chance to explain yeah. and to comment. And so the first then is the inter-imperial international system. What was this and when was it and how did this system shape genocidal actions or genocidal behavior?
Well, this was the international system that developed over centuries in the second half of the last millennium, and which involved the growth of great European empires, which colonized the world between them, and which engaged in warfare against each other, but also against indigenous peoples and polities. In the latter stages of this system, the United States, of course, became another important empire. The Japanese became a significant world empire. And so in the 20th century, in the two world wars, we had an international system characterized by major conflicts of these whole bunch of empires, not only the mm-hmm. Americans, the Japanese, but all the big European empires, the British, the Germans, the French, etc. And of course, also the Russian Empire, which and the Ottoman Empire in the First World War, and the Russian Empire became the Soviet Union, which in a sense was another empire, another imperial sort of polity in the middle of the 20th century. And the rivalries of these empires generated these two most terrible world wars, and these two world wars were the context in which the nationalist rivalries between a whole number of different peoples and states became more and more genocidal. And this, and so we, whereas in the earlier phases of this inter-imperial system, in the 18th and 19th centuries, we had a lot of relatively small-scale, relatively low-level genocidal violence by colonists against indigenous peoples in the late 19th and especially in the first half of the 20th century. We had much larger scale targeted violence generally being run by states, or at least by radical regimes running states. And so we have these very big, well-known episodes like the Armenian genocide during the First World War and the Holocaust and the rest of the Nazi genocide in the Second World War. But we have a lot of other genocidal violence as well in this period. This is a classical period of genocide in the sense that it contains some of the episodes which most people are concerned about when they think about genocide. And I think it's very important to see how these genocides and other genocide in this period was produced by the international conflicts and conditioned by the international conflicts which were taking place in that time.
Just one other thing about this, and that's to go back to something you touched on earlier about our focus on things like Armenia or the Holocaust. One of the things you suggest is that the implication of that, or one of the conclusions that has been drawn from that, is that genocide is usually state-centered and performed acted out by state-controlled institutions or organizations or individuals. And what I see you suggesting is that that's certainly true in some cases, but that much of the genocidal violence in this period is actually not state-centric.
Well, in the first half of the 20th century, and particularly in the World Wars, the Second World War above all, I think genocidal violence mostly is state-centric, more state-centric than in other periods. Yeah, I think if you look at the colonial genocide in the earlier centuries, that is much less state-centric. There, very often it's the settlers themselves or the local colonial governments or local militias. And the big imperial governments far away in Europe are indirectly involved, not very closely, often with what's going on. Sometimes they are, but in many cases they're only indirectly and at a distance involved in these processes. In the genocides of the first half of the 20th century in Europe, generally speaking, radical regimes like the Committee of Union Progress regime in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, the Stalinist regime in Russia in the 1930s and 40s, and the Nazi regime. These are at the center of the genocides which are taking place, and other states as well are involved in this period. And also, although there is always in all these genocides, there is a non-state element. There is element of popular participation. There are non-state actors who are involved. But nevertheless, it's much more top-down than it had been in the past. And I would say also that it's much more top-down than it became often in many cases in the period after the Second World War.
Yeah, and thank you for rescuing me from a poorly worded question. So it was, in fact, colonial violence that I was thinking of.
Yeah.
So let me rephrase that a little bit and ask, compared to the other two periods, this is a very long period of time. And I'm struck by that fact, and about how in this 200 or 300 or 400 years, depending on how you want to define it, you can have this kind of colonial violence side by side, or maybe not side by side, but integrally related to these more state-centered kinds of violence. And is there a change in the essence of the international system that moves or shapes this move from colonial genocide toward this more state-centered violence? Is that the wars and inter-imperial conflicts you refer to?
Well, I would say it's not really a change, a dramatic shift in the nature of the international system, but it's a culmination of processes which in the earlier periods don't lead to such radical radical genocidal developments in Europe itself. During the 18th and 19th centuries, the European empires are basically still conquering the world. They are competing with each other in far-flung places. They are not fighting large-scale wars against each other, except perhaps in the beginning of the 19th century with the Napoleonic Wars, which is an interesting context to look at, because we particularly in France, we have the episode of the Vendée, mm-hmm. which in some way prefigures what happens later. But of course, what is also happening? So what is happening is really one thing is the way in which the competition between the European empires, which is now drawing in also the United States and Japan at the beginning of the 20th century, becomes a competition over space in Europe as well. And the sort of violence which colonial empires practiced in the colonies, often through surrogates, through the colonists themselves, in the 19th century, returns to Europe. And once it starts to happen in Europe, it becomes often much more intense and much more state-centric, because also as this competition develops, the states themselves are changing. The nature of the state at the beginning of the 20th century is different from the beginning of the 19th mm-hmm. century, and states have much more power. They've mobilized all the resources of industry, and they are able to engage in violence, to project violence, not only in wars against each other, but also against civilian populations in genocide.
So the next period you talk about is that period, I'm just going to characterize as that period between the end of the Second World War, or roughly, and 1989, which many people kind of conventionally call the Cold War. And so I'm going to ask you to talk about this period and whether you think the Cold War is a useful label for this period when we're thinking about genocidal violence, or whether you'd rather talk about it in some other way.
I think it's difficult to avoid the Cold War as a label for this period, I'm happy to use it as a label, as a starting point, if you like, because the Cold War is the overarching international conflict of this period, and it appears to dominate what's going on in the world, and to some extent it does, and in very important ways it drives what's going on. But there's a lot more going on in this period. I think this is the most, in many ways, the most interesting period of the three that I discuss in this book, because I think it's the one which has been least discussed in the genocide field. The Holocaust and the Armenian genocide, and the violence of the first half of the 20th century in Europe has been very well covered in some ways. The recent violence in places like Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur, and many other places, this is something which we are dealing with today. Many social scientists and others are looking at these events, but this long immediate past of ours, which is the gap between the Holocaust and what's going on today, is something which we haven't really looked at. There are a lot of people who are starting to look at particular episodes within this, and I've tried to draw on their work. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody else has really tried to pull this together. So I found myself struggling in some ways, because it is quite a challenge. And the challenge, it seems to me, is to sort of disentangle the specific Cold War elements from the other things which are going on in this period, which actually are also driving genocide and which are indirectly related to the Cold War, but not so directly a consequence of it. So, for example, I would say that in East Asia, from the Korean War through to the Cambodian genocide, we have a history of genocide which is very much tied up with the Cold War. The Korean War itself contained genocidal violence. The the Maoist regime in China was at its most radically genocidal with the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution in the period when China was internationally most exposed, when it faced enemies both in the United States and in the Soviet Union. So that was a unique period from the late 50s through to the early 70s when the most terrible things happened in China. The Cambodian genocide itself very clearly related to the Vietnam War and also to the international conflicts within communism, which are to do with the rivalries between China and Russia. And so I see this as this pattern of genocide as very much connected, very directly connected with the Cold War. And another broad region in which genocidal developments seem to me to be Cold War linked, very more closely Cold War linked, is Latin America, where the anti-leftist violence in places like Guatemala, Argentina, Chile, and in other places, but particularly in those, Colombia. This seems to have a very close Cold War connection. It's very much a case of repressive military regimes linked to the United States taking violence against those they see as Cold War enemies and communists and so we can see those sort of patterns. But on the other hand, there are broad regions of the world in which, you know, the things which are happening are tied in with the Cold War, but which are much more driven by decolonization in the sort of conflicts which took place as colonial powers disengaged. I think we can see quite a lot of genocidal violence. And later, of course, the conflicts within post-colonial states, the conflicts over who's going to run the state. So I mentioned before, you know, the history of genocide in Rwanda started before the 1994 genocide. It started just after the end of the colonial period when the Belgians handed over to the Hutu nationalists and the previously dominant Tutsis were then discriminated against and indeed massacred. So this is a case where, you know, where genocide is linked to decolonization, and to the struggle for the post-colonial state. And that struggle can take place as it did in Rwanda, where people are struggling to control a particular state which is existing and which they agree should continue to exist, or it can take place also in the context of wars of secession. And many of the worst genocidal episodes of this whole period from the late 40s through to the 80s are connected to wars of secession, where one nationality, the dominant nationality or regime using a dominant nationality uses violence against the people who want to secede, who are seen as supporting the secessionists. And so we have a whole number of contexts where that sort of thing is going on. So it's a complex pattern of genocide in this period, which is linked to all these different dynamics, which are of course interrelated, but which are, I think, need to be separated out.
And then, of course, the third period comes after the collapse or simultaneously with the collapse of the Soviet Union and runs to the present.
Yes.
How did you characterize the system?
The international system is changing because whereas in the previous period, the international system was polarized between the two blocks. And when I make the point of that, in many ways, it's a three-way polarization because China, for most of that period, was a sort of third pole, and that was important to the history of genocide. But in the aftermath of the Cold War, we have the so-called unipolar moment when the United States is unprecedentedly dominant. The Soviet Union implodes, and one of the things I look at is the way in which the end of the Cold War and the implosion of the Soviet Union are linked to some of the worst genocidal crises of the recent past, in the not only in former Soviet region itself, in places like Armenia and Azerbaijan and Georgia, but also in former Yugoslavia. The Yugoslav wars are very clearly a result of the breakup of the Soviet Union, the breakup of the communist system, and the demise of communism. But I also suggest that this change in the international system, which at least in the 90s and the 2000s made it look as though the United States was much more powerful, even more than it had been in the previous past because the Soviet Union disappeared. This also, in the context of the new wars that the USA was involved in the 2000s, and posed genocidal dangers. And one of the cases which I talk about, which I think is interesting, is the what happened in Iraq. And of course, it's something which is very topical today because these problems have come back in a new form in 2014. But in the aftermath of the American invasion, which is very much made possible by the sense that the U.S. has no serious rivals, that there's no great power like the Soviet Union to constrain America from using its undoubted military power. You know, they go in and they invade this country, and of course, I'm not suggesting in any way that the Americans commit genocide, but what they do is they open up a conflict between different new emergent factions within Iraqi society, which itself starts to take genocidal forms because the Sunni-based militia attack the Shiites, and the then Shiite militia attack Sunnis, and both of them try to drive people who don't belong to their particular brand of Islam out of the territories which they control. And the other sections of the population, other groups in the population, like the Christians and the other minorities, are very, very vulnerable, and many of them suffer massacres. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of low-level genocidal violence. It doesn't fit the model of the Holocaust or Rwanda even. It's something different. Mm-hmm. But it's I think something which is very typical of our time, that we have this sort of thing going on.
So that's a remarkably quick kind of walk through your ideas, and I just want to recognize that and point out to the listeners that the book is a deep, thoughtful, sustained argument and well worth reading to get the additional information and to get the additional depth that actually reading it would give. I want to conclude with a few broader questions. And one, you mention in the conclusions, and you kind of start out by framing this by saying you were at least in part an activist. I'm wondering what genocide studies, so I guess it's kind of a two-prong question. One is, I wonder to what degree genocide prevention should be about activism, or at least about having concrete action to create change in the current world. And I guess the second part of that is, what you can say about genocide prevention based on your work?
This is a very important, but also for me quite a difficult topic. It's important because, I don't think anybody who studies genocide does so without being interested in how to stop this sort of evil occurring. I think the moral and necessarily also political dimensions of genocide research are always going to be there. Having said that, I mean one of the arguments of my book, which I think I alluded to earlier on, is that really we need some distance between academic genocide research and activism. We need at least a distinction of roles, that these are two different things, and they have two different sorts of agendas, really. And the academic agenda is always going to be to look for the complexities, to look for the difficulties of the proposed solutions as well as the advantages of them, whereas the activist obviously is bound to look for the one thing or the two things that can be done now, which will really change things about a particular case which is going on. Where the two come together in this book is often quite critical, I suppose. Quite a lot of what I'm saying is really to suggest that some of the agendas of genocide prevention are too simple. That genocide is a deeply embedded problem in our world. That it's morphing into new forms in the 21st century in many different places, and there are no simple answers. And that when you if you like, charge in with an international intervention, you can sometimes make things worse as well as make things better. I don't try to say that that one or the other. I just say that we need to be aware of the problems there, and we need to be critical of sometimes of those who advocate intervention as well as critical of those the interests which actually prevent interventions when they could actually help people who are suffering. So I suppose, based on the book, I don't have a simple answer. My writing this book, for me, in many ways, made me more critical of the simple demand for humanitarian intervention or military action based on the responsibility to protect than I was when I started it, because I came up against the cases in which this has been quite difficult and has had negative consequences. And I think the problem of intervention in the world today is very much bound up with the dominance of great power politics for example, the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation and the other great powers. We've seen in Syria the way in which Russia has been able to prevent the United Nations doing anything. And I think, for me, one of the directions in which I would like to see things going is to activists to recognise the difficulties of putting the onus always on the United States or on the Western powers to solve these problems. I think we need a movement back from military action and looking at the whole framework of international order. We need to look at why the international legal institutions that have been developed are so limited in their scope and not able to take on many of the cases which have come out. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous that the Syrian conflict, for example, has not been referred to the International Criminal Court. But it can't be with the lineup of forces in the Security Council which we have at the moment. So I think we need to. I mean, it's not really an easy message that the book is giving. I think, and the book isn't directly giving a message, but the message which I would give today is not an easy message. I think it's a message that these issues of genocide and genocide prevention are bound up with the great power politics of the international system in ways which are often very difficult, and that it's not always easy to find ways through to help people. We will obviously look for what we can do in these situations, but I don't think there are easy answers.
And that maybe anticipates the next question I was going to ask, because we have a new interdisciplinary core here where I teach at Newman, and so I've been doing a lot of teaching with natural scientists and social scientists, and they keep telling me that one of the values of theory is that it suggests further avenues or questions for research. So I'm wondering what the next steps are that are suggested by this research. Where should genocide studies now go?
Well, I think I really only opened up a new sort of historical approach linked to a heavy emphasis on the international and global framework, rather than the idea that you can look at genocide neatly within national packages. I mean, this is I've opened it up in a way that builds on a certain amount of important work which has been done, particularly by those who've been working on colonial genocide, like Dirk Moses, or people like Donald Bloxham, who've written about the international system in the first part of the 20th century. I don't think that there is yet enough work that looks at genocide from this sort of macro international approach. And so in one book, I can only propose a sort of framework, and I can only sketch a narrative, which is really what I've done, to enable this sort of discussion to take place. I think what needs to happen is for there to be a lot more empirical work on many different cases that we can see in the recent past as well as in the present, and for a dialogue to take place, really, between those of us who are looking at things at an international or system level, and those who are the historians and the empirical social scientists who are looking at particular cases and who are analyzing things in greater depth. I mean, I've tried to have this sort of dialogue within my book and to draw on the work that many of these people are doing. But I think there's an awful lot more to do to frame the argument. And I think another direction which maybe is important is as we become conscious of how the international system is changing in the first part of the 20th century, how this post-Cold War international system is not what we thought it was going to be in the 1990s or even in the 2000s, but it's becoming something again in the 2010s, and will no doubt change further in the 2020s, 30s. We need, I think, to look very hard at what is happening in international relations, what is happening with the sorts of conflicts which are taking place in many parts of the world, and that the role of genocide in these conflicts, and the ways in which the changing international system is creating new contexts of genocide. So I think the work that needs to be done is partly historical, but it's also, I think, future looking. It also needs to be looking at the present and where things are going now, because I'm very concerned about the patterns which are recurring and developing in many parts of the world.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time, Martin. I appreciate it so much. I'd like to end with the last kind of traditional concluding question, which is just to give you a chance to say what you're working on now, whether it's something, again, with some of the issues of genocide studies you just highlighted, or whether it's something completely different.
Well, I have, since I finished this book, the Genocide and International Relations, which I suppose was finished now about 18 months ago, I've been working on a second edition of my What is Genocide? And I've actually found this a very interesting process to go back to the conceptual questions after writing this historical analysis, and also to take in the enormous literature which was developed in the last decade. I first wrote the first edition of that book about 10 years ago nearly, and in that time, because this is an exciting developing field, a lot has been written. So, for example, I felt that I really had to completely rewrite my treatment of Raphael Lemkin, because a lot more has been, not only has his a lot of his work being uncovered, but a lot of people have written about this and analyzed it in very interesting ways. So I just finished doing that, actually. This has been what I've been doing over the last 6 or 9 months. And at this point, I don't have another project. I feel, in a way, I have said most of what I want to say about genocide, and that I ought to think whether I should be going in other directions. But I haven't really decided. So watch this space.
Well, wonderful. Well, I want to thank you so much again for your time. It's been wonderful. And we look forward to seeing that new edition. And wish you a great summer of contemplation and relaxation.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. You've been listening to an interview with Martin Shaw about his book, Genocide and International Relations, Changing Patterns in the Transition of the Late Modern World. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time for a special episode of the podcast. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. To recognize this, the next show will feature a panel discussion around the question, what do we now know about the Rwandan genocide 20 years after? Scott Strauss, Lars Waldorf, and Leanne Fuji will all join me to help answer this question. A bit of editing has delayed the posting of this podcast, but it should be up next week, and I hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, thanks for the download, and have a great month.